Okay, welcome everybody. My name is Jan Pimblett. I'm going to be the chair for this session on public museums and the invisible queer community. Our speakers for this session will follow the sequence that is in your programme and will speak for about 15 minutes, give or take. And at the end of the session, there'll be a chance for questions and discussion. There'll be enough time to do that. So without further hesitation, I'd like to welcome Iris Ellenberger to the podium.
Thank you. Hey, everyone. Just let me get my slides. Sure. How do I do that? I don't know. Can anyone help me out? Thank you. Thank you. Now, I want to introduce to you a project that is called the Rainbow Thread, or A Rainbow Thread, which opened at the National Museum of Iceland in November of last year. And it is a collaboration between the museum and the National Queer Association and grassroots activists and queer scholars. Just to start by talking a little bit about the National Museum, it's Iceland's main museum when it comes to Iceland's cultural heritage. Its permanent exhibition is called Making of a Nation. And just to quote the museum website, it says that it is intended to provide insight into the history of the Icelandic nation from the settlement to the present day. And the aim is to cast light on the Icelanders' past, and it asks what makes a nation, or in this case, what makes the Icelandic nation. In a 2006 interview with Gay Iceland, the Icelandic museologist Inda Gestsson brought up the fact that there was no mention of queerness in the permanent exhibition, that queerness had no place in Icelandic history, as it was told by the National Museum of Iceland. The article circulated quite widely on the internet and was subsequently answered by the director of the National Museum, where she said that it was a misunderstanding that queerness had no place within the museum. And just to quote her, she said, "It is in the museum's agenda to cover all ranges of society and celebrate diversity. This includes queer people, which has been the focal point of exhibitions and events before and will be again. We would love collaborations on this word offered." And so we offered, and the museum accepted. The Rainbow Thread is a grassroots initiative. It was started by Inda Gestsson, Ásta Kristín Benediktsdóttir, who's sitting here in front, and myself. We are three queer researchers and volunteers at the National Queer Organization. The Rainbow Thread was organized, carried out, and written by a group of queer researchers, students, and activists. It ended up being a cooperation between the National Museum and the National Queer Organization after the three of us that I already mentioned, we reached out to both parties and they both accepted. It was on a volunteer basis at first, all the work was done on a volunteer basis, but later in the process it got some funding from the Icelandic government as a part of the National Queer Organization's 40-year anniversary celebrations. But what is this rainbow thread that I'm talking about? In a nutshell, it is a queer guide through the permanent exhibition of the National Museum of Iceland. And it takes two forms. One is a booklet and the other is an audio guide. I wanted to bring a bunch of these booklets with me, but unfortunately the museum had run out and the second printing was not in yet. But I managed to get hold of two of those, and Ásta is going to have them circulate so you can all take a look. It starts on the ground floor like underneath the semicircular stairs you can see on the slide. There on the wall is an introductory text by the entrance, which is also in the booklet and also in the audio guide. It includes a welcome note. It includes a welcome note which addresses the questions about what makes a nation, who is included in the nation, and so forth. It also asks the question, what is queerness, which in this project is defined as a social construct which manifests in different ways in different times. It states the purpose of the guide, which is to convey information about queer life in Iceland, demonstrate how ideas on gender and sexuality take different forms in different times, to ask questions, examine the unsaid, and encourage critical thinking. Then, after the introduction, guests are invited to go up the stairs to the second floor where the main exhibition starts and follow the rainbow thread through the exhibition on the second and the third floors, which you can see on this map. There are 12 stops on the way at the locations that are indicated on the map, and those are at particular displays, and their guests can read or listen to the accompanying text, which usually does one of three things. It provides additional information on subjects related to the display at that particular stop. An example of that is the chapter A Cure for Ergi, which is at location 58, which deals with learning and sorcery in the 15th and 16th and 17th century. And it adds to the information that is already there by citing a little known text which talks about a remedy for Ergi. But Ergi is a negative term for male femininity in general terms. And it takes many forms, such as being penetrated by another man, cross-dressing, and so forth. Secondly, the guide or the text in the guide provides a queer reading or interpretation of the display at a particular stop. And one example is the text called Skeletons, which is at location 10, where there are skeletons in the floor, and the main museum text says that these skeletons are of a man and a woman. There we use the opportunity to talk about gender and biological sex to get people to question what 1,000-year-old skeletons can tell us about the sex and gender of the people they belonged to. And thirdly, the text addresses absences or silences, and one example is simply the text called Silence, which addresses the gap between the Middle Ages and the 19th century in the thread itself, because we have very little information about and research on queer sexualities in that period. So we use the opportunity to address that fact instead of ignoring it. Most of the stops do these three things that I already mentioned, but the guide finishes at the conveyor belt of history, where you see the picture of this conveyor belt there. And it displays Icelandic heritage in the 20th century. There, the guide addresses the absence of any visual representation of queerness on this conveyor belt, like in the 20th century. It also asks questions about how to visually represent queerness, questions like what is a queer artifact? And there we use our favorite example, which is a wooden butter knife somebody gave to us, which was used in the break room of an old Icelandic organization, queer organization called Félagið. And we use kind of that as an example to ask questions about what is a queer artifact, in what ways in this artifact queer, can it be considered a queer artifact, in what ways is it not, and so on. So in a nutshell, that is what the Rainbow Thread does and what it consists of. I would like to finish just by talking a little about why we chose to do it this way, and what kind of it, you know, what it did for us and for the display and for the museum. One of the main reasons that we chose to do it this way is the simple fact that queer studies are a relatively new subject in Iceland, especially within the field of history. So the information that we have is very fragmented. But doing it like this way, making a queer guide, allowed us to use the little that we still have in a productive way. It also allowed us to question the established narratives of Icelandic nationality and Icelandic history, which we felt was at this moment in time more interesting or more useful than making trying to make a new grand narrative for the history of queerness in Iceland. It also allowed us to expand on the main exhibition's theme and ask questions like, who belongs to the nation? What are the terms of the belonging? How does the exhibition, the main exhibition, reflect and shape this belonging? And thereby we could address the absence of queerness in the exhibition as a part of larger discourses on Icelandic nationality and Icelandic history. It also became the thread also became a platform for other events, for instance, lectures on queer history, also student visits, because it enables us to kind of demonstrate to students how queer history can be used in praxis. And then I'm talking about like students of history at the university. We also had an uncensored version for Museum Night. It's an annual kind of evening activity with all the museums in Reykjavik. And then there we could like use fragments that we had and didn't know what to do with. And so we recited obscene poetry, recited 150-year-old diary entries about dildos, and all sorts of fun stuff like that. So it gives us the opportunity to have other events and kind of use more fragments of queer history in a productive way. I think just to end on a downside, I think the main problem that we had by doing it this way was the lack of ownership by our main collaborators. The National Museum kind of looked at it as like the queer organization's project and vice versa. So it became a little bit of a problem when it came to promotion and follow-up. In our experience, the experience that we kind of draw from this is that it's better if the initiative had come from the museum itself. If there was someone from the museum on the team actively involved in shaping the project. And this kind of goes to show that, in our opinion, that it's not enough for a museum to be interested in these projects and claim that they're willing to take others up on their invitation to collaborate on a project. That it is better if they had taken the initiative themselves and invited grassroots organizations and queer scholars to collaborate and lead the project. But as far as we can see, the project is going well. We're on the second printing of the booklet. Other museums in Iceland have expressed an interest in similar projects, and it seems as if it has kind of opened their eyes to new ways in queering their exhibitions and the story that these exhibitions tell. So I think that's it for now. Thank you.
Okay, our next speaker is Klaus Müller, who'll come up here. It's like a game show, come up here.
I just want to close this. Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming and listening. I will not talk with an institutional affiliation, but more reflect my experience in the museum sector over quite a while now in North America and Europe, and where my optimism went that I had very much in the beginning, and which I wonder if I still have it. It's called The Invisible Visitor, Museums and the LGBT Community. Diversity. For decades, discussions at American and European museum conferences on how museums can broaden their audiences have been lumped into this catch-all, a code word for the underrepresentation of ethnic and sexual minorities. Diversity has become an overused term, like change, like community, and these terms again and again claim and promise a new awareness in museums of social changes all around them. But real, tangible and structural progress is often lacking. Why have Western museums not become more inclusive in their staff representation, acquisition and exhibition policies, and more broadly, the world that they claim to present to their visitors as our history, our cultures, our lives? And in contrast, we can watch numerous LGBT series on Netflix every week, delve into academic explorations, into histories once obscured, follow queer writers everywhere, or consume mainstream Hollywood movies, biopics on once closeted gay voices. So why is it then when I enter the realm of museums, it feels like time travel, backwards, into a sphere in which LGBT people and communities barely seem to exist or matter to the world museums are preserving and portraying. So my question is, the world has changed, have museums? And despite highly visible national and global debates on LGBT equality, history and culture, art or history museums and their permanent exhibition seem to remain often unaffected. Though educational institutions, museum at large did not react to the bigger questions of inclusion and exclusion raised in these debates, nor change their outreach, their acquisition, or education. In their label texts, museums often struggle with a language that hides as much as it indicates. And rarely do curators include references to LGBT life in exhibitions, though extensive cultural and historical studies have been produced. Homo and transphobia, one of the most aggressive expressions of hate in contemporary society, is not on the radar screen of museums and their educational divisions. LGBT visitors seem to remain what they always have been, invisible visitors. And going into museums feels at times like going into the closet once again. What's new is old, so the call for visibility. Often when we investigate a new topic, we discover that it has a long history, and there is, in fact, no vacuum of knowledge when it comes to the relationship between museums and their lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender visitors. It is not new for LGBT people to urge the documentation of their lives and history within a public context. The relationship between queer identity and visibility has been discussed since mid-19th century. And I focus on Germany, but I think also because in Germany a lot of these discussions started. German Karl Heinrich Ulrichs, who designed the modern discourse on same-sex desire, integrated the rule of law, references to cultural and natural history, theological and philosophical excursions, all of that in a radical plea for equality. In 1865, he demanded the recognition of same-sex relationships. In 1875, he published the first gay journal, and his formula of the third gender inspired a whole new set of gay and transgender identities. Magnus Hirschfeld extended his work through connecting science and human rights. So the call for a documentation of LGBT people within history, science, or art united many diverse voices: writers, cultural critics, scientists, activists. And Germany, as you might know, was pretty much at the center of this debate until Hitler's rise to power. Hirschfeld's Institute for Sexual Science, with its first ever exhibit showing LGBT-related artifacts, was looted by Nazi students in May 1933, and within a short time, the historical singular tolerance, at least in urban Germany, towards deviant sexual orientation and gender identities was history, and then made place to state-sponsored persecution and murder. Both in post-war Europe and North America, small lesbian, transgender, and gay human rights groups needed decades to recover. And post-war trends in homophobia in the Western world effectively closeted discussions on LGBT cultural representation until 1969, Stonewall, and the second LGBT movement in Europe. So are museums actually agents of change? In the 19th and 20th century, the sphere of culture and art served many gay women and men as a safe haven within a hostile world. Museums, of course, have been long aware of their gay visitors, staff, and donors, regulating the engagement through imposing a pact of silence. As silent visitors, gay women and men were mostly tolerated in museums. In recent decades, have LGBT people and communities set out to reclaim their history and challenge cultural institutions that traditionally have ignored their presence. This cultural shift marks the end of a closeted relationship. The mainstreaming of LGBT history, if we look at Netflix and others, seems to be a matter of time. However, few museums have engaged the LGBT community as a potential new constituency, a specific audience, or an important source of funding. The question now museums face, if and how they can transfer this closeted relationship. And this turns out to be a difficult question. Museums were and are not agents of change. They preserve the cultural accepted. They lead as powerful consolidators. Museums wield power in the social and cultural acceptance of a nation's value system. They define a culture also by what they exclude. And historically, museums use this power to erase LGBT history from the world we remember. Historic sites and house museums have straightened the biographies of gay women and men who created or once owned them. City museums erase the known and detailed and documented lives of their LGBT citizens. Art museums obscured the works of LGBT artists by omitting connections to their signifying codes and their lovers, their lives, and their networks. Natural history museums propagate the animal kingdom as a heteronormative heaven. And memorials omitted those who were killed by state-sponsored violence. So why do we think of museums as safe spaces, as partners, as agents of change to ensure we are granted a life and afterlife? So working in the museum sector for 3 decades, my perspective have changed. I want to offer some suggestions on the inclusion of LGBT cultures in heritage institutions and 3 statements why I no longer believe that these suggestions will work alone. First, LGBT material culture or why change is not imminent. Objects and original documents are initiators of narratives. Discrimination of LGBT lives over the last centuries often led to its detailed description in police, medical, and legal documents. The love that dared not speak its name was discussed by writers, psychiatrists, cultural critics, military personnel and self-appointed guardians of morality. Today, such documents projecting the transsexual, the homosexual, the lesbian as other are material sources, autobiographical documents, photos, artworks, journals depicting LGBT lives. And they can be reinterpreted beyond their historical denunciation. Museum collections could be reviewed for LGBT-related artifacts they already hold. And museums could really help in the preservation of an endangered LGBT material culture. Marginalized groups often do not believe that they could hold objects of interest to others. Museums could work, and some do, with LGBT historical archives and expert historians to compensate their lack of expertise. With the research published over the last decades, knowledge could be bought, integrated, and used. At present, most Western museums have no structural policy to identify, preserve, and integrate LGBT history into national memory. The relationships between museums and LGBT-related objects is marked by absence and negation. But will museums address this as a priority? And this is my first statement. Museums will only change if they are forced to do so from the outside, through government policies or private donor preferences on inclusive heritage acquisition, education, and exhibition. They will not implement tangible structural change by themselves because they do not think that they have a problem. Second, framing LGBT history and culture or fundamental misunderstanding. LGBT cultures have been reduced to a history of deviant sexuality and gender, which is a major obstacle for museums to present LGBT cultures as significant and even uplifting contributions. One positive lead narrative developed by Western cultures to feature LGBT life is the coming out, an established initiation ritual with recognizable codes. As this biographical approach is so prevalent on how we understand LGBT lives, museums might be tempted to add just that, biographies, in the form of a hero or a victim. My second statement, museums do not address the real story at hand. As society, a culture defines itself by what it excludes. Exclusion is self-identification. The real story is not sexual behavior or gender expression, although an interesting aspect, but the social, medical, legal, and religious layers of exclusion through which Western societies subjected deviant sexuality and gender expression. Why? With what reason? To what end? Without addressing this key question, museums will continue a marginalizing frame to safely store LGBT history in some corner, somewhere. Third, outreach and inreach, or are museums really open spaces for everyone? Museums could develop direct communication with LGBT groups, media, and cultural leaders. LGBT History Months or Pride Days are easy connectors, and some museums have started to use them as opportunities to schedule programs. Outreach to diverse constituencies often leads to changes within museums themselves. Ideally, this inreach extends to all institutional divisions, from exhibitions to education to development. LGBT museum professionals work in museums as professionals, not as experts on their own history. It is not their responsibility, but of the museum's leadership to guide the institution through any changes in approach. Leadership is the decisive factor in how LGBT history is represented in museums. Outside consultants can be used as initiators, but once the work is done, however, their expertise needs to be absorbed and implemented as a structural change of the appropriate museum division. And we do see some changes, and we just heard one. But overall, there seems to be a lack of urgency. Why? And this is my third statement. Museum leadership, boards, and donors thrive on the conviction that museums are open spaces for everyone. Museums do not feel that they are exclusive or not welcoming to diverse audiences. They are informed by surveys again and again that the public trusts museums more than any other public institution. For decades, museums have retained their visitors' trust and loyalty, and they value this recognition, however undeserved. Museum leaders see themselves as curious, open, educated, and as individuals, they very well might be. As leaders of their institutions, however, they do not confront the institutional collaboration of museums in the erasure of gender expression and same-sex desires. And they do not want conflict. They understand that LGBT topics might lead to conflicts. The public trust into the neutral and objective voice of museums defines the museum power base, even when this is an illusion and when museums, by definition, can't be neutral. Museums praised as open spaces for everyone are cautious to engage into conflict as it damages their brand. Diversity not only means enrichment, but challenges museums to mediate social conflict between divergent and maybe hostile visitor groups. Without clear ethical leadership, museums will do an occasional exhibit, but continue the structural marginalization of LGBT history. Epilogue. Museums are reflections of society. Individual staff interested into LGBT history and culture can and will make a difference. If museums fall under government policies, they will adapt. If donors from the corporate world come in, museums might adjust to a diverse workforce. And when society's mainstream LGBT cultures, museums might even follow and implement structural and lasting change at last. Until then, we live in a gay world. Only museums do not know it. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Pierre Lascar. And so if you'd like to enter this space, the space of power.
Thank you. Can someone help me with this? I'm happy that I'm coming after you. Okay, thank you. I will present a project called Unstraight Research in Museums that went on for 3 years and share some of the experiences from that project. And first, a little background. The backdrop is that queers who were working at museums, with different museums as technicians, they grew tired of building heteronormative exhibitions. So around more than a decade ago, they started to challenge the museums by organizing debates where queer scholars like myself was invited together with critical heritage scholars and museum professionals for to discuss the marginalization of LGBTQs in history and how to question heteronormative narratives in the museums. These activists also invited museums to take part in a large collective exhibition called Article 1, referring to a human rights declaration, on queer history and queers in history, and about 10 large museums joined this exhibition, and it opened during Europride 2008 in Stockholm, and then traveled around East Europe for some years, And eventually, when it arrived to Serbia, some people there took the initiative to create a digital museum called the Unstraight Museum, TUM for short. And this digital museum collects artifacts digitally, of course, photos of objects and the story that queers this object. And they also collect oral stories, film or tape, and yeah. So that is the webpage, but it's down for the moment because they are reconstructing it. And they aim to now produce or build a physical museum somewhere in Sweden. Well, but after some years of challenging the museums by who wanted to include marginalized gender and sexualities, TUM realized that when it came to build such exhibitions, they were not permanent. They were like, produced during special events and occasions such as Pride festivals or memorial days of different sorts. And nothing happened with the permanent exhibitions. So TUM continued to be on the museums, and eventually with allies on the Royal Armory in Sweden and the Swedish History Museums, TUM designed a project called Unstraight Research in Museums for to develop a method to queer permanent exhibitions. And this project was funded by the Swedish Art Council. And initially, the project aimed to rework collections and exhibitions from an LGBT perspective and add on LGBT representatives to permanent exhibitions. But when I applied for to become the researcher in this project, I challenged that point of departure. And instead of always adding LGBT perspectives to an already heteronormative narrative wasn't my goal, so I thought that it was better to study the making of sexual ideals and gender norms and how these were produced in different historical contexts and periods, and also study deterrents and threats to those ideals. And I got a job, so I had a strong mandate to queer exhibitions instead of add LGBTQ perspectives. And I was supposed to develop a method, and I did so by using an American Asian queer scholar called Kevin Kumashiro, who has written a book called Traveling Education, where he has studied how teachers and pedagogues wants to what kind of strategies and methods they use to include marginalized groups. And I sort of converted or reworked those methods and started to use these questions or try to collect different strategies within the museums by naming them with this exhibiting for the other, which means to make exhibitions for queers so that we shall recognize ourselves in history, or exhibiting about the other so that other people can see that there has been queers in history. Or exhibiting that is critical of privileging and othering marginalized groups. And the fourth is exhibiting that changes visitors and society. And I can talk about those for ages, but I will not troubling you with that. but that was a method to sort of encircle different strategies and make professionals in the museums to start to reflect on what they were doing and why they were doing it and what shortcomings and problems comes with each of these strategies. So I have worked with three exhibitions during these 3 years. The first one was an art exhibition called History Unfolds at the Historical Museum, and it was an exhibition that challenged the museum's own usages of history regarding norms on Swedish looks, the nation, the narratives, and so on and so forth. And critical perspectives were already the core of this exhibition, so to deconstruct heterosexuality was not so very difficult to implement within the production team. In the exhibition, we presented, for example, a grave finding from the Iron Age where two men and a baby were buried. And these human remains, there were no human remains in this exhibition, but it was a photo of the remains. They had, by archaeologists, long been considered as two adult men and a baby. And two adult brothers and their little infant brother. However, these human remains had recently been tested by a DNA test, and the result was that none of them was closely related. And the attribution of kinship to these three people demonstrates how researchers and museum staff in the past have made heteronormative and anachronistic assumptions of their findings. But instead of calling the people in the grave a queer family, the exhibition used the old biased interpretation for to question every previous heteronormative interpretation of all grave findings. You know, if they find someone who have a female pelvis or a male pelvis, they immediately think that these are a married couple or that they was together somehow. But it could be a brother and a sister. So that was the question we posed around interpretations. I have also worked with Royal Armour's new permanent exhibition. It opened just 10 days ago, and takes its point of departure in the power processes by which the monarchy has been legitimized since the 16th century in Sweden. My method to work with that production was to arrange a serial of workshops discussing how shifting sexual politics could be linked to legitimizing or delegitimizing monarchic power. So we studied, discussed, and contextualized the sexual politics of time and space. We also discussed kings and queens who had been accused for rupturing gender norms, and rumors about the royalty's deviant sexualities. And the PowerPoint I'm showing is the result. These are texts that now are in this permanent exhibition on the monarchy and power in Sweden. I don't know if you can read the sign. No? Well, it's about King Christina. She was inaugurated as a king, actually. She lived in the 1680s, something like that, and she was brought up as a prince, and she was dressed as a man in many occasions and so on and so forth, and she broke a lot of gender norms, and it was also a lot of rumors about her sexuality, as she shared bed with a bedfellow who warmed her bed, a woman. All these things were okay until she abdicated and converted into Catholicism, and her father was the great Protestant warrior king in Europe. So that was a big scandal, of course. And then they started to delegitimize her by using accusations of her deviant sexuality and deviant gender and so on and so forth. And that is what we try to discuss in this exhibition. And another thing that we highlight is a king living in the 20th century. He was accused for having a homosexual affair. He was blackmailed by a man. I don't know, can you read this? He was blackmailed, and different people used the accusations for to delegitimize him. The working class movement did it because they were anti-royalists, of course, and they were, you know, highlighting corruptions and, you know, perversity in the nobility and so on and so forth. And we expose his embroidery kit, this king's embroidery kit, and different things. But and then there is a little note there that the ban on homosexual acts were lifted in 1944 in Sweden and classified as a disease until 1979. But this is the ways we are sort of queering the monarchs in the exhibition. And I don't know how much time I have left. 3 minutes. I tried to run on a little bit. Well, when I also came to the Historical Museum to queer their new permanent exhibition that will open next year about Vikings, the great thing in Scandinavia, as you know, I thought I should land like an UFO with my ideas, but not. When I arrived at the Historical Museum, I learned that there were no Vikings during the Viking Age, and I was like, what did I miss? The answer was that the people during the Iron Age did not call themselves Vikings. It was a concept that arose, and listen very carefully, during the 19th century in a context when Sweden lost Finland to Russia and the Swedish national feelings was very wounded, and a way to heal that was to invent or colonialize a glorious past. So along with the nationalist story of the Viking Age, those who did not fit the narrative, such as other peoples that plundering seamen or other economies than trading or robbing overseas, other religions and ways of lives were excluded from the narrative of the Iron Age in the north, as were women, children and slaves, and Sami people and a lot of other people, sorts of people. So this kind of deconstructive analysis allowed me to say that there were no heterosexuals during the Iron Age. The concept arose in the 19th century in a special context, and at the same time, other sexual expressions were excluded. And they were like, yes, because they were already familiar with that deconstructive way of thinking. So that was, you know, a way of getting into these different kind of exhibitions. So I will just very, very quickly end with that it's so very important to work with scholars and academics in the universities and elsewhere that are questioning gender binary and heteronormativity and so on and so forth. So after just half a year, I started to discuss with the National Secretariat for Gender Studies in Sweden. It's attached to the Gothenburg University, and they promote gender research and defend gender research against hateful media and so on and so forth. And We decided to start this network, Cultural Heritage and Cross-Disciplinary Gender Research, and it's funded for 3 years. This is the third and last year. And we have conducted a lot of workshops where we have invited professionals, heritage professionals, activists, artists, researchers to work together and discuss how to include marginalized perspectives. And the first step was to conduct several workshops on the theme obstacles, possibilities, and the next step. And it was very, very interesting because even though people had the same aim with an exhibition to be more inclusive of marginalized experiences, they could, as professionals, have slightly different aims. You know, scholars need to present results in a special way, very important with the numbers and things like that. Activists often prefer to address injuries or resistance, desire fast results. Scholars can take 2, 3, 4 years before the result is on the table. While museum professionals deal with funding, space, technologies, time limits, they don't want to step on people's toes and so on, and curators and artists might follow more intuitive routes to express knowledge and do it more creatively than scholar. And there's a lot of discrepancies between professional terminology and common usages of certain words, like critical, for instance. But I need to say before I end that I think it's so crucial in these times of right-wing attacks on humanity, social sciences, cultural heritage, other stories, other narratives, the constructing of this nationalistic narratives that museums represents. It's so very important to work together with universities, I think, because it nevertheless the people in power in the next election, you know, they cannot close down universities and museums that quickly. So we have to keep together. Thank you.
Okay, our next speaker is Daniel Sander, and who will actually also be joined at the end by Brandon Wallace. Okay, thank you.
All right, so I'm assistant curator at Leslie Lohman Museum of Gay and Lesbian Art in New York, and Brandon's the registrar. So I'm going to talk briefly about an exhibition I co-curated, last year, and then hand it over to Brandon. This is the intro wall for the exhibition. And also thank you to the organizers, to my fellow panelists, and to all of you for being here. In this talk, I suggest that one way we might queer memory, which would be to differentiate it from a gay and lesbian memory, and to queer what currently counts as queer art, would be to intervene in the predominance of visual depictions of embodied anthropocentric sexualities by delocalizing sex from genitality. And works by contemporary queer artists I have encountered through my curatorial practice, queer memory is conceptualized beyond the specificity of same-sex object choice and through the eroticism and sensuous qualities of materials. Andre Lepecki has described the political gambit of what it would mean to do so. He asks, what is the style of neoliberal imperial colonialism that both manipulates and is manipulated by contemporary hegemonic monohumanism and its aesthetic objects? It is the style that finds in the reinforcement of identity as representation a way to perform unquestioned institutional good intentions. Or as Travis Jepson has recently more succinctly asked, why does queer equal body? As Lepecki and Jepson signal, in much of what counts as queer art, queerness is stultified into an equation that can be institutionally incorporated. Felix Gonzalez-Torres described this happening to him and his work in a conversation with Ross Blechner in Baum magazine in 1995. The way it works is that the press tells you there's going to be an art show at the Guggenheim, and that's all they say because it's a straight white male show. But if it's somebody else, some other, it's a show with two gay artists at the Guggenheim. And that is very damaging, because when someone is labeling you, it's for the purpose of justification, which is always defensive. I'm gay, but I don't make work about being gay. It's also a way of keeping us bogus by giving the center such an importance, because that center is always there. It's art by straight white males. I do have a problem, Ross, with direct representation of what's expected from us. What I'm trying to say is that we cannot give the powers that be what they want, what they're expecting from us. Some homophobic senator is going to have a very hard time trying to explain to his constituency that my work is homoerotic or pornographic. But if I were to do a performance with HIV blood, that's what he wants. That's what the rags expect, because they can sensationalize that. And that's what's disappointing. Some of the work I make is more effective because it's more dangerous. We both make work that looks like something else, but it's not that. We're infiltrating that look, and that's the problem I have with the sensational literal pieces. In response to a gay art that is direct, literal, representative, identitarian, sensational, and exoticized, and that is consequently simultaneously both easily dismissed by conservatives and assimilated by liberals, Gonzalez-Torres proposes a certain set of tactics and politics of making in which queer content is sublimated and subsequently spread through metaphor and transubstantiation, an infiltration, a bait and switch. In terms of intersectionally marginalized subjects, Jose Munoz has famously described these tactics as disidentificatory performance. This is Jose. A disidentity that potentially informs an anti-identitarian identity politics in which commonality is not forged through shared images and fixed identifications, but fashioned instead from connotative images that invoke communal structures of feelings. We initially proposed this show at least 3 years before it happened, and in the intervening years, queer abstraction became the subject of many shows and books. Nevertheless, we hope to offer a new approach to it. This begs the question of whether or not abstraction is even the right word to describe much of the work in the show. During a recent studio visit, an artist and I arrived at the word oblique to describe her work, and I currently prefer this descriptor. Based on our experiences at the museum and in queer culture more generally, in which homosexuality is equated with representations of nude bodies, predominantly white cis male ones, we initially had an idea for a broad historical survey of queer abstraction. For logistical reasons, primarily of space and cost, we then decided to focus more narrowly on contemporary and local examples of queer abstraction. Even with this focus, we still came up with four approaches to it: cyborg formalism, faggot minimalism, lesbian expressionism, and pervert materialism. Again, for reasons of space and cost, we had to go with only one of these, pervert materialism, which became haptic tactics. Pervert materialism was initially conceived around a sensuous and improper use of mediums, but was refined to focus on touch and texture, but less on the actual experience of touch and texture, as you could only touch two pieces in the show, and more on the imagined experience of touch and texture, which is one way to define the haptic. The three curators probably approached marrying objects to this concept differently. I tend to proceed intuitively, selecting objects that I like and post-rationally finding and marrying them to a conceptual through line, either through close readings or more often than not surface readings. In any event, we would meet with objects in mind, sometimes different, sometimes the same, and discuss until we came to some sort of agreement. Congruent with this show being anti-mimetic, I would say that it's also anti-narrative, at least in terms of telling a coherent, linear story. That said, different rhythms were emergent, such as different approaches to the haptic, the digital, the effectual, the historical, and different approaches to mediums, soft and hard resins and plastics, plush vibrant textiles, and heavy metals. We wanted the audience of the show to be an intervention in terms of the demographic the museum had historically attracted. Of course, as one reviewer put it, one need not be persuaded by the curatorial positing of these modes as queer to enjoy. However, reaching younger people, reaching people of color, reaching gender nonconforming people were all concerns, and this is another way in which the haptic has been explicitly theorized, as a way of knowing for marginalized subjects for whom dominant and normative forms of display might be inaccessible and/or inadequate. Contrary to the claims of art canonical abstract expressionism, which resolutely remained a boys' club, an amorphous landscape of multicolored fabrics might offer more points of entry for a broader audience than a nude self-portrait of a white man, while at the same time still coming from and referencing a culturally specific intersection and not reducing difference to an assimilationist multiculturalism. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First, I'd like to just apologize for me being late and not being up here at the beginning. I was actually meeting with my husband and our lawyer because we are going through the process of having we're married, and my husband is immigrating to the U.S. And as you know in the media, the current administration is not very kindly. So. I'm coming from a very passionate talk where we have to prepare for the immigration, our last meeting after basically about 2 years of meeting with a lawyer to get to the point where we are. So there's a lot of anger and passion with me. And so I'm going off script. I'm querying this right now. Thank you. Because I shouldn't have to justify my love for my husband. That a man that I met on the platform when he walked after talking to each other online after 3 months of talking, we just hugged each other and we held each other for a good 10 minutes and didn't say a word. And I knew that this was the man. And yet it's frustrating. And so I look at this and I'm lucky to be in a career where I'm working at a museum that looks at gay and lesbian art and has been doing it for 50 years. We've come, I'm sorry, plug, but Amazon.com, we've just come out with a new book that looks at our collection and where we are in 50 years and what we're doing and what we want with the collections. It's called Queer Holding, and you can get it. It's a wonderful book. And I was going to talk about this and talk about what we have in the collection, but what I'd rather do is talk about language and talk about, I'm basically preaching to the choir here. The talk that we all are giving are sentiments that we all have. Who controls language? And right now I'm controlling the microphone. I'm sorry about that, but I really want us to network, because the more of these I go to and the more frustration I feel is like I need to be in contact with every single one of you, because we are dealing with same issues and the same problems. What is language? Who controls culture? How do we intervene in this? And this is important issues. And also because of the times that we are in, we don't know when it's going to be taken from us of what we have and what we value. So there's an urgency for me that any libraries out there that want to also know what we have in the our collection, our periodics, all of them, I would love to give that information to you. And likewise, be a protector of your information that we have and share. We should be causing a language, an understanding. There's already heteronormative structures that are set up for archiving, for cataloging, for doing all of this. And yet, are we communicating with ourselves and the specific collections that we have? Are we communicating as professionals? And this is a question. So would you please just talk among, I mean, would like you to get your business cards out or airdrop your information and talk to the people that are next to you. Make sure that they know, have your information. If you could do this right now, and just, it's a congregational kind of thing. Just make sure we're sharing all of this information, because I don't know if we're having time during all of these lectures, and I'm certainly not. But why I want you to do this is because I'm Brandon Wallace, it's brandon@lesleyloam.org. I want to see a lot of your emails to me and making these connections, because this is important, and language is important. We're all doing our amazing job of what we're doing. Let's share that and make a collective force, so we have colleagues, we have the benefit of knowing each other. And if I'm serious, please, Drew, share, please. I know it's very awkward, and we're not usually, I'm scared as hell what I'm doing and asking you right now and talking, but please, it's really a plea for to make sure that we're making this connection. I think everybody that has spoke, that I got a chance to, every single sentiment that I could say in my lecture has already been said, and so thank you. I think I've caused...
Well, I think we should thank our entire panel right now. You chatterboxes, come on. And I think that's actually a really wonderful ending, because as you say, there is this amazing work that's going on, but actually it's what we started with today, is get up, get out there, do something, be proactive, be together. That's great. We've got a little bit of time. Actually, we've got quite a bit of time if people want to ask questions. You've already started a discussion, those of you who are swapping cards and doing the thing, which is great. So I don't know if anybody... Are we using the mics on the table for the speakers?
There
yes.
There are.
That's cool. So... Does anybody have a question out there? Yes, we have a question. So here, here, and here. So there's three questions. And you've got one.
Yes, thank you very much for that. And thank you for that very heartfelt talk at the end. I was actually going to ask sort of a theoretical question. Is Klaus right? Or do the others sort of show that he's not completely right? Or... But you completely threw me off there. You woke me up and you reminded me, why are we doing this? You know, why is this super important? And why should we keep doing it, no matter whether we have one perspective or another perspective? Or, you know, it's just so important that this work that we're all doing. And yeah, thank you for that reminder. Yes, and thanks to all of you. This was a wonderful panel.
Right, next question is at the back there. Wave your arm. Yes. Be bold.
Little backstory. I used to work as the archivist for the Freud Museum in London, which is a house museum. You might know it, Dan, actually. One of the people who lived in the house was Anna Freud, Sigmund Freud's daughter, and she lived with a woman called Dorothy Burlingham for over 40 years. I found, in the entire time of cataloguing both of their collections, I found no evidence that they were a couple, but they were clearly had a very close friendship. And as a question to both the panel and anyone else who would like to talk to me about this in the next few days, how would you deal with a situation where you think there may be a queer relationship involved with people who didn't self-identify in that way, when you don't have enough information? So you don't want to perpetuate the inevitable invisibility, but you also don't want to, you know, reclaim people who maybe aren't ours to reclaim. So any thoughts would be great.
Okay, would anybody like to respond to that?
I love this question, because I also did put my teeth into that story. And indeed, from that perspective, where's the evidence? How can we really be sure that this was a lesbian relationship? And I think in time, I step back, and I think the easiest would be to describe that relationship as it was, indeed 40 years long, very intimate, very much a couple, and that... Anna Freud, I think, was also clear that she didn't want to be labeled as a lesbian, but this was her partner's choice. This was a relationship she lived in, and that we kind of point out that people have the right to choose the way how they want to understand themselves, and that not the categories that we invent and reinvent in time might not the categories that they have chosen, but nevertheless the lives that they have led come to the conclusion this was a partner. If it was ever sexually, it's, I don't think, really important. But they lived really together and there was nobody else.
Yes.
You should listen to Asta Kristin tomorrow, because she's presenting on a project where we're dealing with couples such as these, where we just call them lifelong partners, and you know, for us we define them as queer. I mean, they live together for 30, 40, 50 years, maybe, as a couple, and it doesn't really matter, I agree, like, if they had sex or whatever. If they were a man and a woman, you would never, ever kind of question their partnership, so why would you do it if it's two women? Yeah.
I don't think that there's going to be a smoking gun. I mean, just the people that were involved in the relationship were actually there during the act, so anyway, it's innuendo if they've not spoken out. So, and it's more about the experience, the visitor experience. I think also what's important is what is not said, for reasons of social norms. Could they give a card that said, you know, with flowers that said, "I love you," because that would be a smoking gun. It would say, and it would disclose them to all of the vial of what socially is constructed around it, of not that they couldn't have that. So what's also important is what is not there. And I think making note of that is important too, because that is evident of stuff being there. And again, it's all to the experience, the visitor's experience. You read that, you personally had that experience that this is a couple. There's no question in your mind, and you're looking for, you know, kind of evidence, and that's the fragment of doubt. But for you, for the experience was, I read this as queer. There's no way about it. And I think that there's going to be a population, and there's going to be people that see that. And then also, hopefully, that you're offering a window of opportunity for people that don't, like heteronormative people that would read it in a way that has been constructed, that they actually see that, oh, wait, this is possible, that this was a relationship, a queer relationship that had happened. I think leaving that open, saying stating what was not there, really adds to the benefit and the information that you can present.
Great, and I think we have one more response.
Yeah, well, many things have already been said, but I think that opening up a window to the past is important, and you can do it with, as you just said, discussing the condition or the context for being in a relation when same-sex sexuality was forbidden or criminalized. How could you come out? And that can give rise to discuss a little bit what to come out was about. It's also an historical thing, you can start up a lot of discussions without saying that this or that person were lesbian or a gay man, as we did with this king. We were discussing how different people addressed these allegations against the king, and we were also showing the effeminate things he was into, like embroidery, and I think you can also open up spaces for guides to come in with histories that perhaps cannot be written in the signs, give a space for creative scholars or guides that comes from outside, artists that can be more innovative or artistic in their way of discussing these things. And there is someone from London here that also have the same problem as you.
Is it me?
No. historical house that is Alison something. Are you here?
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's in the U.S., yeah. She's from Australia. But anyway, there are a few people like you around.
I continue?
Yes.
I'm Christiane from Vienna, from the Belvedere 21, from the Museum of Contemporary Art. And we just recently had this public program about queering the museum, and of course it started a lot of discussions. And we are looking now into the collection, and actually I have a question for Iris and Pia, because I would like to know if this, your rainbow thread, and also your working with this work with the historic museum, is this like implemented in the museum and will it stay there like on a permanent basis? This first question. Second is, how did you fund this? You allocated funds from within the museum, or did you have to do external fundraising? Thank you. And I keep the microphone.
Could you repeat the first question? I didn't.
Could you repeat the first question?
My first question is if this rainbow thread is permanently implemented in the museum, this tour you offer.
Well, I mean, it can be there for as long as the permanent exhibition is there. They're talking about like renewing it to a new permanent exhibition, which is great. So because now they know like who to call if they want truly to like make that queer. So it can't be there because it's basically a wall sticker and then an audio guide and a booklet. So it can be there as long as the museum wants it there, but you know, you never know how long they want it there. They haven't talked about a time limit, so we don't know. And what was the second question? Funding. We got the museum committed to like to funding the booklets and all the material stuff that needed to be in place in the museum, and then the National Queer Organization applied for funding to the Icelandic government as a kind of a birthday present for its 40th year anniversary, and part of the grant that we got from the government went to the Rainbow Thread.
And were you seeking another response?
Yeah, and the funding for UNSTRAIGHT Research in Museum is from the Art Council of the... It's a governmental fund. It's not from the state history museums at all. They haven't funded with one crown. The network, they are funded overhead costs, and they are funding my visit here. But no, it's external funding. But it's implemented in the Royal Armoury. The signs are implemented in the permanent exhibition, and there are more signs, so you should really go there. And I don't know the result from the Viking exhibition because it's not ready yet, so we don't know what if they are buying my IDs.
Okay. Any other questions from the floor? Okay.
I actually had a follow-up comment to this discussion about Anna Freud and you bringing up language, which is, it seems to me that one of the way heteronormativity continues to claim space and empower itself is through certain kinds of assertions, and that we have to be careful not to be too timid. If there were a home of a heterosexual male and female, the museum would have no question about presenting that as a lifelong relationship. There just wouldn't be a question. And yet we continue to have to go through these doubts and this agony, and I mean agony very seriously. I'm not throwing that word around lightly. So I think the time to be timid is passing, and maybe this is just because of contemporary politics that I feel this way, but I feel more strongly about it every day.
Yes. so I hope I'm not here. Yeah. not ruin the party, but just something that I was, because everyone were so open here. I have a question that actually I keep thinking about since I came this morning. I see the audience, I see the speakers, and I cannot stop thinking about the fact that they are around, it's queering memory, and it's about almost 80% cis gay men, maybe, I don't know, 10% lesbian, whatever. What the idea that I don't see so many trans women, and even trans men, holding positions, even as the audience, I think from my way of seeing life, I think I saw 4 or 5 trans women here, and I can be quiet about it, but I think it's not a coincidence. I think, and I'm not saying about the context, I'm saying because I know there is more and more museum that shows stories, definitely trans stories, but I'm talking about being behind a position. And my explanation as being a trans woman, as being an artist, that most of my friends, other trans women, are actually not even have any academy background and just surviving daily. But nevertheless, I think it's not enough. So actually, it's a question. Mm-hmm. It's a comment, and yeah. So I'm curious to know if someone were thinking about it this morning, since he was here, about the fact that you don't see so many trans people in general here, on mostly trans women, or it's something that was like okay.
Go on.
I think exactly reiterating, and this is all of us, a call to all of us, is that we have to realize that we're a community, and we all need to start standing up for everybody in this community. And I think we have a show up right now at Leslie Lohman Museum honoring Sylvia Rivera and the work that she did during Stonewall and post-Stonewall, and how she was, she and Marsha P. Johnson were both tireless advocators for queer liberation, and yet they got marginalized and even put aside even further. The show is called Y'all Better Be Quiet. Oh, Y'all Better Quiet Down Now. And it is taken from her speech that she was booed off stage and saying, look, you're not including me. You're becoming, you know, you want to become normal and accepted, and you might think they're not going to come for you, but they're going to come for you.
So I want to say, because I definitely know about this exhibition, and I know about the speech that Sylvia Rivera said. And actually what she said, I think it was 78 or
yes.
No.
Yeah.
She spoke to a cis gay man, and she said, because they didn't let her to speak on the main stage in one of the squares, I forgot,
yes.
Washington Square. So nevertheless, I mean, I guess the exhibition was very beautiful. I didn't see it, but I'm talking mostly about behind the scene, about the positions, about the idea that still, even in your museum,
yeah.
Again, without any, I think you do a brilliant job. It's not about you. It's about the fact that
but
in your team, you don't have any.
Right, exactly. You know. We need to push for that. We need to ask these questions. We need to ask about why are we having so many shows around that Stonewall 50 is happening, mm-hmm. and then it's going to go away. And these are questions that we need to be proactive about. Why do we not have any transgender members on representing us? This is a part of our community. So I completely feel this. The onus is on us to bring these questions, and just exactly, this is a good question to ask, because we need to talk about this as a community, and especially a community that does is important on pushing culture and showing and preserving it for the future. We want to make this mm-hmm. legacy, or we want to make it better for our predecessors or whoever takes over our job from what we're doing. We want to be that's my goal, is to be better for whoever is going to take my job, so they don't have to complain about what I did or wonder why the decisions that I make. So I think bringing this question up puts it in our forefront, to bring it there. Why isn't there more people on the board? Why aren't there more the representation of the trans community, transgender community up here talking? Those are good questions. And I think being more bold about it, not being afraid. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you for the question. It's crucial. I just wanted to add that Inta Gestsson, who was on our team doing the Rainbow Thread and the one who kind of started it all, she is a trans woman. So without her, this would never have happened. So as you point out, that it is crucial to have trans people, genderqueer people, people representing like all the flags of the rainbow, if you want to put it like that, behind the scenes. But still, she is not like permanently employed at the museum. This is a grassroots initiative. But I mean, it's extremely important to have all kinds of people in the museums. So yeah, thank you for this question.
Okay, two short responses.
Building on what I said before, this is the reality. This is a field in which you don't have true diversity, while this is a field that talks about diversity for many decades. So yes, is an underrepresentation of trans women and men. There's also an underrepresentation of people of color. There was just a very kind research of leadership in art museums in the United States. And leadership was always, people of color always underrepresented in leadership positions in art museums in the United States. And it did rise by 2% over I don't know how many years. So nothing is really moving behind the screen. So I think it's good to just point this out, that nothing is moving while we talk about it endlessly.
I think also it's an important thing that you raised with the intersectional perspective that is also missing. I mean, people of color and all sorts of people. But one way I think I'm promoting anyway is that we... when we exhibit, when we are producing, creating an exhibition, we should also perhaps curate what is missing and what was the point of departure for this exhibition, what is missing, what question is raised, and what questions are not raised. I mean, in a way, a little bit like we do when we are writing an scientific academic essay. And I think that could be created and that could bring up questions about the lacks and what's missing, actually. But then we have also the structural biases or the structural lacks that must be addressed in many, many different ways, I think. And it's not just to say that our museum is open for everybody or this job is for everybody. We have to be recruiting people by having a program for, just recruitment. Mm. And otherwise we will just recruit our own twins. And then a lot of people will be missing.
Thank you very much for that. Time for one last question.
Hey, since Brenton didn't get to talk about Leslie Noman, he welcomed me there in April and showed me around, and they're doing amazing work. And do please email Brenton. He's amazing too.
Okay. Right. Sorry. Well, that's exciting. Right. Okay, well, thank you very much again to the panel, who've been fantastic. So a round of applause for them. And thank you to you for some really, really good questions. And I think the really important thing to take away from this is shouldn't be a talking shop. It's not about, well, we've noted that question, let's put it on the file, although I come from an archive, so you kind of put it on the file. But it is about how do you use that information, those conversations, to effect change. So swap your cards, talk to each other. Thank you very much.